Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from the top of the hill in Southbury, Connecticut. Tonight, we open season 5 with our 49th episode called Pilgrim's Mood. Stay tuned as we talk about how to make travel more meaningful, the difference between the tourist and the traveler. Joining us is author Phil Kuzeda. Phil Kuzeda is an award-winning writer and filmmaker, teacher and editor, lecturer and travel leader, storyteller and TV host. His fascination with the art, literature, and history of culture has taken him from Michigan to Marrakesh, Iceland to the Amazon, in a worldwide search for what the ancients called the soul of the world. With more than 35 books and 15 scriptwriting credits to his name, the omnipresent influence of myth in modern life is a thread that runs through all of his work. His books include Stoking the Creative Fires, Once and Future Myths, The Art of Pilgrimage, The Hero's Journey, Word Catcher, The Painted Word, The Oldest Story in the World, The Book of Rhodes, and The Accidental Aphorist. It's a good 15 years ago that I encountered Phil Kuzeda's book, The Art of Pilgrimage, after I had done some traveling of my own throughout South America and a little bit throughout Europe. I asked myself, how do I make this travel more meaningful? And I found his book. This book influenced the way I thought about travel, introduced me to the term pilgrimage, and opened my mind to a different set of possibilities about what it means to be in the world. His book opened my eyes to the deeper wander and the mood of a pilgrim. In tonight's long conversation, we break this down. We look at the difference between the traveler and the tourist. We ask ourselves, are there mentors out there in the world that are helping us see the world differently, seeing the underglimmer? And what better way to start our conversation but to find out the inspiration for the art of pilgrimage? So how did you get thinking about meaningful travel, this notion of pilgrimage? From your family, from your own searching? Where did your widely read book come from? Where did this idea come from?
We traveled as a family. We read books out loud together. Part of the family folklore is that our 6-foot-high Philco television broke down once when I was maybe 10 years old. My father spent a few minutes trying to fix it, got frustrated, kicked it down the basement stairs and said, dramatically to the family, we're going to read books out loud together. And so we did, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. For several years, we all read a page apiece, and the classics from Homer to Grimm's Fairy Tales, Mark Twain, and so on. Yeah. And many of them were exotica. I think that's a word some of your listeners might know. Romanticizing the world outside of our world, which was growing up in Detroit, Michigan. And so my love of travel begins there. I've been traveling since I was a kid with the family and then on my own in college. After university, where I graduated with a degree in journalism, I had tremendous job offers in Detroit to be a burgeoning travel writer or a sports reporter, but I decided to travel. And I told everyone I was going to go away for 3 months. I traveled for 3 years around the world.
Yeah.
And it changed everything. In a sense, it's a kind of self-imposed PhD program for young people if you are curious, yeah, rather than just traveling with prejudice. Remember, you probably know the famous Mark Twain quote, travel is the death of prejudice. But that's assuming we're traveling open-minded. So I've been traveling all around the world for many years, both as a backpacker, but then as a travel writer, a filmmaker, someone with a TV show on PBS called Global Spirit. But the Art of Pilgrimage was a kind of threshold for all of this work. Many years of writing and filming on the road. Well, around 1997, I was reading in the New York Times Sunday Travel Magazine, sometimes what they call a bullet point. It was just a 2 or 3 line item about how by the year 2000, so this was 3 years away, the prediction was that travel would surpass the armaments and the computer industry as the biggest business in the world.
Wow.
So that really caught my attention, partly because many of your listeners remember the old biblical injunction, how we must turn swords into plowshares. Uh-huh. It's even part of it's a folk saying,
right.
Swords into plowshares. And I saw that immediately, symbolically, that's what was happening. We were spending more money now on traveling around the world to see other people, experience other ways of life. And so I began to dig around. How is this possible? Why are we traveling more? Well, it's cheaper to travel, it's safer to travel, and so on. But then I found this other item, that the surge was partially due to a precipitous rise in pilgrimage. And I didn't see that one coming. But I saw record numbers going to Rome because 2000 was the Jubilee year for Christianity, but also record numbers of people going to Mecca and Medina. 1 million people at one point were going down the Santiago de Compostela road.
Yeah.
And then it began to open up. Sometimes when you're researching, you find you're pursuing one topic, and suddenly the word you are obsessed with pops up everywhere. And I saw references to families taking pilgrimages to the Cooperstown Baseball Hall of Fame.
Right.
And then pilgrimages to James Joyce's and Emily Dickinson's homes. So literary pilgrimages. And then I saw a reference to going on pilgrimages as a way to talk about safaris in Africa. And now something opened up. I saw an opening, and this is what I think a good writer is always looking for, not just an interesting topic, but a brand new way in to the topic. So I wrote the book very quickly. For me, it came in about a year, and it's unusual, and it's different from other travel books, because I'm looking for the metaphor there that because it's easier, safer, cheaper to travel than any time in human history, it also means that many people are leaving home unprepared. They don't feel like they need to read. They don't feel like they need to prepare whatsoever. And so you can plop down in Stockholm, in Nairobi, in Jerusalem, any place around the world, and you'll find many, many interested travelers, but also what I call the Peggy Lee syndrome. She was a crooner, singer, a torch singer in the 1950s, and her most famous song was, "Is That All There Is?" And that's a phenomenon that I have named, which partly inspires this book, The Art of Pilgrimage. When you arrive in a place, you look around and you say, oh my God, it looks so much better in the movie. Or it felt better when I read about Prague in Milan Kundera's The Unbearable Lightness of Being. What that means is you didn't prepare. You haven't met the destination halfway with a sense of respect and reverence.
Yeah.
Suddenly, then I had my metaphor that pilgrimage is not just the old pious view, let's say, of listening to Gregorian chant and walking with your hands folded as if you're in prayer, walking to Jerusalem or Rome. No, pilgrimage is a metaphor for going someplace with deep respect, deep reverence, and a profound attention. And it doesn't mean you're not going to have any fun, but what it means is you're opening yourself up for meaning.
Yeah.
So many people are traveling and finding zero meaning. They go home, they're disappointed, they get snarky about foreign cultures. The pilgrimage then, for the last 20 years for me, and that's why I think the book is in so many printings, I believe it's in 12 languages around the world, I get mail from some corner of the world virtually every day.
Oh,
and
wow.
Not just email, handwritten letters, handwritten postcards. And invariably the response is, thank you for writing this book because I found some meaning here in Machu Picchu. I found some meaning going to Easter Island. And for that, if for no no other reason, I'm very happy to have spent that time writing this book.
Yeah. So the people that are emailing you or writing you letters or sending you a postcard, they found your book because they were searching for meaning.
The difference between tourism and travel. Can we go into that for just a second?
Of course.
I think that could be really useful for people. Tourism is a relatively new word. It's probably only a couple of hundred years old. I think it pops up around in the early 1800s, around the time of Thomas Cook, of all people, of Thomas Cook Traveler's Checks and the Thomas Cook Travel Agency. And it's because he is given credit for organizing the first, and here it comes, I'm a word guy. I've written whole books on word origins. I love words, and it's important even in travel.
Uh-huh.
A tour is around. It means you leave home, you go on a long journey, and you come back again. That's a tour.
Huh.
So he used the word tour to describe a trip that he was offering from the north of England down to the Crystal Palace in London and then back home. I believe it was to Birmingham in the north of England. And so I believe he's given credit for the word tourism. What it means is you are going on a round. And the inference with this, and this is haunting to me, I think it's in the book too, his very first travel poster advertises at the bottom of the poster, travel with us, 2 weeks in London, whatever it might be, perhaps the next, and the line in the bottom is, no surprises guaranteed. That line signals the future of tourism.
No surprises guaranteed.
We shouldn't be too snarky about it because it's kind of hard to believe now, but what I have read in places like Anthony Burgess of Clockwork Orange fame, he wrote a book on the history of the Grand Tour, and he writes that before Thomas Cook and travel in the 19th century, roughly 50% of people who traveled in recorded history never returned home.
Hmm.
Travel was so dangerous because of food, health, robbery, wars breaking out. So when Thomas Cook says, no surprises guaranteed, what he's saying is, your hotel will be safe. The train will be safe.
Yeah.
The problem was that set up a whole pattern in which there was no adventure. Everything is laid out for you, and that becomes the model for tourism. Exploration technically means you are going to a place no one else has ever been. A real explorer is going into brand new territory.
Yeah.
So that's a word I like to keep aside. Travel, by the way. Travel is an old word that goes back to, of all things, the medieval rack. It goes back to tripalium, which was being stretched on the medieval rack. And I like that as a metaphor for travel because it means either your ideas are being stretched, you're being challenged, right, by going to brand new places in Africa or Asia, or travel can be torture. And travel is torture for people who are not prepared. They can be embarrassed or ashamed or intimidated by new places out there in the world. Pilgrimage is different from those in the sense, it's an old Latin word which means walk through the fields, per agrum.
Mm-hmm.
And what it means is walking, getting off the bus, getting off the plane, getting out of your car, putting the soles of your shoes to the sole of the earth, but for a particular reason. You're going to a place that is sacred to you as an individual, your people, your tribe, your family. Now it gets psychological because there is this inherent belief I found in cultures virtually all around the world, from the Aborigines 60,000 years ago in Australia to Native Americans going on vision quests today. The belief is that you leave home with a sense of sanctity, of reverence, and you go to a place, let's say where your family began, where your people came from, or your religion began, or your favorite writer was born. And there is, now here's the key, it's really to my book and so much of our talk today. At that place where you are going for the pilgrimage, for the sacred journey, without getting pious about it, there is a tremendous amount of energy.
Yeah.
Some people would call it spiritual. Some would say it's physical. Some would say it's geological. But these places are different from ordinary places because of, and now everybody has to fill in the blank themselves, because something special happened. Jesus walks down the Via Dolorosa in Jerusalem. So 2,000 years later, we walk in his footsteps.
Right.
You walk to around Paris in the footsteps of Charles Baudelaire or Anis Nin. Why do we do this? But you go to Paris and there are thousands of people walking in the footsteps of famous painters, sculptors, writers, filmmakers. Why? Why? And I believe it's because there's this ancient belief, it's probably DNA deep in us, that if we replicate the behavior, the moves, the actual walking itself, that their energy will infuse us. And that's the origin, really, of the word inspiration. It means to take in the spirit of the world.
Yeah.
And I find that really humbling. It means it's who you are, who I am, who our listeners today are. Partly it's you and your individual will, but it's also recognition that there are profound energies out there in the world, Kevin, that you and I can tap if we travel in a humble way.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition.
In the intro to The Art of Pilgrimage, you you mention Basho's glimpse of the underglimmer, and I love this. And the way you describe it is an experience of the deeply real that lurks everywhere beneath centuries of stereotypes and false images that prevent us from truly seeing other people. Or maybe here, in terms of like the pilgrimage place, other places and other times. I mean, is this us seeing the other layers then?
That's right. I love Basho. He's, in a sense, he's one of the earliest, sometimes what are called poet and then hyphen, poet pilgrims.
Yeah.
So some pilgrims are so interior that they don't write or paint. They don't leave anything behind. But there is another tradition of people who are on various kinds of pilgrimage who are writing poetry or they're sketching. These days, some people are making short videos or podcasts and so on. That one word just shook me to the marrow, the underglimmer.
Yeah.
And the reason I love it is because it suggests that with a certain kind of attention, and again, this is a practice. It just doesn't happen accidentally. You have to believe that there is something important and beautiful and necessary out there in the world, and you have to be humble if you're going to see it. Otherwise, we become, and I want to be careful about the language here, but we become victims of pop culture.
Yeah.
We become victims of the entire, and I'm being careful with the language here, the prostituting of some cultures for the tourist dollar. Mm. So when you go to a culture, it could be Bali, it could be Tanzania, where I know you spent some time, it could be San Francisco, where I live.
Yeah.
Because tourism is a big part of so many cultures and economies now, it also means that some places are being varnished and burnished to, as the Irish say, a fare thee well. And when you arrive, you really have to look twice. You have to think twice. Well, where do I go that's real?
Yeah.
They want me to go here, but who is they? Is it the Chamber of Commerce? Is it this huge hotel chain? Is it an international conglomeration that wants me to go to Fisherman's Wharf here in San Francisco, and then in Paris, you've got to go to Montparnasse? If you're not careful, you're walking in the footsteps, of course, but in the footsteps of sheer economic, manipulation.
Yeah.
And what that means, and I think that's why you get that kind of glassy-eyed look on so many tourists. They're walking around, and many people are not even reading guidebooks anymore. They're just looking very quickly on their smartphones to see what is popular. And that quantity alone will never get you to the soul of the culture.
Yeah.
If you're just looking to see how many people ate at that cafe or had a beer over there or how many people went to that gallery, you are not going, you're probably not going to a place that's authentic. You're going to a place that's popular, which is not the same thing. So my metaphor, again, of the pilgrimage is scratching the surface, you might say, and looking and asking questions and finding out and the old way of saying this would be, where is the soul of Paris? Where really is the spirit of Greenwich Village?
Yeah.
If so much has been contrived just for the tourist dollar, how can I get past that?
Right.
Not to be a smart aleck and not to be holier than thou, or as we say here in San Francisco, Berkeleyer than thou. It's to find out what is real.
Yeah.
Because if you're just following the tourist dollar and you're just following some of these new tourist websites that tell you how hip it is to go there because everybody's going there, you know what happens? Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing touches your spirit. My metaphor then of pilgrimage again gets back to here's an overlap. I've also written books on a number of books on soul because I grew up in Detroit in an era of Motown soul music, right?
Yeah.
So soul for me is a really hip word. It's not holier than thou. It's not a pious word. What it means is, as we would say growing up in Detroit, what's real? Get real. We would say things like get real.
Yeah.
She's real. He's real. So when you're saying what's real about Brussels, where is the soul of Dublin? What you're asking, you're scratching the surface of the tourist business to get to the soul of the place. And
yeah.
The soul, by the way, is always the center.
Mm-hmm.
So a question, even when I'm leading groups, because I lead pilgrimages, I lead my own art and literary groups, I lead groups to Ireland and Paris and Greece all around the world. My metaphor constantly is, let's find the center. Where is the music, the
yeah.
real music? Where is the real art scene? Where's the center, the plaza? Where
yeah.
do people promenade? Because if you can find the center of a place, you're finding the soul. And
yeah.
the soul is what the pilgrim is interested in, as opposed to the tourist. The tourist, arguably, is interested in one thing. Where does everybody else go?
Right.
And
so that,
I don't want to be too hierarchical about that. I don't want to oppose one over the other because we're all a tourist at one time or another, right? Even Paul Theroux, one of our greatest travel writers, says invariably we all play the tourist eventually somewhere. But that's not to be all and end all.
No.
That should not be the stopping place or the goal. We can go deeper. Is that fair to say it that way?
Yeah.
We can go deeper than tourism.
I think so. Another quote from the intro that I really like, especially because connects to this idea of our geographical imagination. We like to kind of describe it as the treasure chest of all these images that we have that when put together create our own sort of world, our own mental map of the world. And you say that we have, or the dependence on others' images of the world to imagine how we might walk our own path to the holy ground or your heart's desire. So by getting out there ourselves and in the mode of pilgrim, are we then at the very least kind of seeking out our own images that we then put into our chest?
So much of this goes back to ordinary language. I bet you've used the phrase, I bet you've heard it 100 times. I needed to see it for myself.
Yeah.
That's actually one of the most profound lines in the language. And what it does is it slightly moves past, I'm such an inveterate writer and reader. Books are at the heart of my life. I love being an author, I love being part of all that. But there does come a point when just reading about a place or only seeing it in the movies, hearing it in songs, is not enough.
Yeah.
It's tremendous to read our greatest travel writers, Pico Iyer, Henry Miller, Patrick Fermor. We have so many great travel writers. But there will come a time when you say, I need to see Paris for myself. I need to make this pilgrimage to Fez, Morocco. I need to see it for myself. It's a deeply profound thing. And I think that especially great travel writers expand. I need to hear it for myself. So I'm thinking about the main square in Marrakesh, Morocco, in which it's a sensorium. All five senses are being blasted at once.
Yeah.
The smells, the sights,
yeah.
the sounds in a place like that. Now, that gets underneath tourism, because if you are hitting all the senses, you're eventually going to hit soul or the spirit of the place at once. And then to see it for yourself means that it's going to get through the stereotype. The stereotype would be all Italians are, and then fill in the blank, and all Arabs are like this, and all the French are like this. You see, I'm not even going to use a word because I don't want to perpetuate any of them, but that is what we leave home with. The stereotypes come from somewhere. They come from conversation at home. They come from books, movies, songs. When we see these places for ourselves and we're conscious of the underglimmer, we get to the archetype. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
The difference between the stereotype, the archetype, you're looking at something, and I bet you've had this experience because you seem like a really great soulful traveler, and I bet your listeners as well. When you look at something and say, oh my God, this is the way it's always been. I had that moment in Marrakesh years ago. I write about it in my travel book, The Book of Roads, in which I go to the town square, and it's a twilight, and an old Bedouin who's just wandered in from the desert comes into the center of the square, and he sits in the square, and he uses his finger, and he creates a circle all around him, etched up with his finger, and leaves one little opening in the circle, and then beckons anybody who wants to hear him and his stories to come inside the circle. So about 20 of us sit inside at his beckoning, and then with his finger he closes up the circle, and he begins to tell stories, and he accompanies himself on two or three different instruments. I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, not just, this is cool, I'm getting the real thing here, right?
Yeah.
Which is wonderful, but something else happens at that moment when you think, this has probably gone on for centuries. That's an archetypal moment, and that's the one that makes you shiver.
Yeah.
It sends what the French call the frisson, the shiver, right down the spine. That, I think, is why we travel.
Yeah.
It's not just to see it and be hip and be cool and be up to date. It's to have a moment that really reaches our spirit.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world. The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program or radio essay expedition that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode.
You're mentoring the people that go and travel with you. You're guiding them, and your use of words, I think, is really important here. The term reverie, I have to assume that is new to some people that you encounter. They know what maybe you mean, but they maybe weren't using the word reverie. Or kairos, this is a word that I love. I think it's one of my favorite words of this sort of sacred time. Not the chronological or chronos, but kairos. This something that, again, kind of maybe getting under the, getting to the under glimmer. I mean, to me, those are kind of similar things. The under glimmer itself probably runs on a different time. Is this the role of the mentor to kind of push someone to... recategorize, reshape some of their thinking and their imagination of themselves in the world, and the world itself. I mean, is that the mentor's job?
Yes, to all of the above.
Yeah.
I co-wrote the movie and then the book, The Hero's Journey, about my friend and my mentor, Joe Campbell.
Yeah.
And ever since have been cultivating this notion of the mentor, because I think it is one of the things that makes Western culture distinct from Eastern in terms of teaching. So broadly speaking, we have a guru tradition from the East that has worked beautifully for them for 5,000 or 6,000 years. And what it means is there's a holy person, a holy man, a holy woman, a sage who has had spiritual breakthroughs, can be a carrier of deep knowledge, and essentially is saying, trust me, this is the way it has been for thousands of years. So do your yoga like me, or interpret the Vedas, the spiritual teachings like me. The guru tradition is centered on the honoring of a single individual, and again, very broadly speaking, is not so much involved with encouraging the development of the individual. In the West, we have a very different tradition of the mentor, and because I'm such a word guy, I ended up having to look this up, and I had one of those great aha moments that are so much fun when you're researching. Because it goes back to Homer's Odyssey. In the beginning of the book, when Odysseus is called to war to go and bring Helen back from Troy, he has just become a new father. And he's trying to be a good father. He knows he may go away and never return, or if he comes back, it will be many, many years. So he's trying to leave his son in the hands of somebody he trusts. And there is a family friend called Mentor. Huh. Mentor is the figure who raises the son of Odysseus, whose name is Telemachus. So for 18 years, and then ultimately 20, the son of Odysseus is raised by Mentor. Well, okay, that's a fun story, but if you go deeper into the words, suddenly it becomes relevant for all of us, Kevin.
Yeah.
Mentor in Old Greek means mind maker. And the implication is that the mentor, as opposed to just the teacher who's giving you knowledge and information, the mentor is the one who helps you find yourself. The mentor is the one who helps you find your voice, who finds out who you are, who doesn't say, be like me, but instead, I am here to help you find your spiritual self, to find your deep self.
Yeah.
So what I like to do when I'm both leading groups, but also if I'm teaching writing or movie making, teaching creativity, a simple exercise at the very beginning is, everybody take out a pen and paper, close your eyes, and for 30 seconds, try to go back in your imagination and remember the very first person who recognized you. And it can't be a parent. Parents are too close. Parents can never be mentors. They're something else.
Yeah.
A parent can be an aunt, an uncle, your baseball coach, your flute teacher, a local bricklayer. But the mentor is someone who looks at you and recognizes you and says, you have a talent. I want to help you develop your musical ability or your teaching, whatever it might be. The mentor moment is a deep teaching moment. And
yeah.
If you can find out that mentor moment, the first or second or third person who recognized you as a young person, that energy will take you through for the rest of your life. In terms of travel, in a sense, that's what I am trying to do, but in a very casual way, full of humor and anecdotes, so that there's nothing pious about this, but I am the daily reminder on these tours that I lead. So I just led a tour to Greece last year, another one to Paris, to Ireland. Every morning, I'm there to say, why are you really here? I'll ask somebody.
Yeah.
When was the first, what's your first association with Paris? What's the first time you remember Greece? Was it watching Zorba the Greek with your parents? Or was it reading Sappho, the wonderful poet?
Yeah.
If I can take people back to those origin moments, you know what happens? A tremendous amount of emotion opens up. And I'm not asking, did you read about Greece in the New York Times travel section and you're here because you know it's in Condé Nast, and it's one of the hottest destinations in the world. That has nothing to do with our spirit or our soul. But if I can find out why you wanted to go back to Africa, I can help you as a travel mentor, so to speak. I can help you have an unforgettable experience.
How does the mentor find the mentee, or the mentee find the mentor? How does that moment work? Because that itself must happen in Kairos, right? In more sacred time.
Right. Thank you for bringing up Kairos again. Again, briefly for listeners, the Greeks had two, and some say there were others, but two main gods of time. Kronos is the god of ordinary time. Tick, tick, tick goes the clock. Things happen sequentially. It happens in a world of cause and effect.
Yeah.
The god Kronos is still with us every time we look at our watch or our clocks. That's chronological time. But there is another kind of time, and that's signaled by the god Kairos. Kairos is the god of sacred time. He's the god of synchronicity. He's the god of the moment. He's the god that swoops down with wings on his feet and wings on his shoulders, and at the very last second determines who is going to win in the Battle of Troy. The battle could go either way.
Yeah.
Writers, historians have told us about this. It could have gone this way, but the wind shifted. But these moments are also in sports, where the race could go either way. So Kairos appears in Olympic races. But Kairos also appears in that moment when you are giving a talk or you're having an intimate discussion with your lover and you're searching for just the right word. If your heart is open, Kairos appears.
Huh.
And Kairos allows the absolute right, the perfect word to appear. This dimension, I'm talking about Kairos every day on these travel trips because it helps you to recognize that, of course, we have to get on the bus at the right time. We have to appear at this museum, so-and-so.
Right.
There are moments of Kronos all day. But what I'm trying to set up are a few opportunities every day in my own travels or when I'm filming or when I'm interviewing other people or leading these tours. I'm leaving the window open for Kairos to appear. And without exception, these are the moments that people remember later on. When someone says, hey, tell me, what was it like to be in Cape Town? What was it like to go to Nelson Mandela's cell on Robben Island, where he spent 17 years? What was it like to go to Babe Ruth's school, where he first played baseball? People might say, well, the museum was hip and the restaurants were great. But you know what they'll generally talk about? What we all remember is the surprise, the unexpected.
Yeah.
When something suddenly appeared that felt, it took your breath away. But you have to be open for this.
Yeah.
You have to be open. So Kairos is important for that. One simple suggestion in my Art of Pilgrimage book is, if you're traveling on your own or with a friend or a spouse, your family, at least once in every trip, hire a local guide. Do some due diligence and make sure, maybe a university professor, they are always looking to make $100 on the side somewhere. If you walk around, let's say Salzburg, one of your favorite cities, I know, or Amsterdam, if you spend some time with someone who is local, knows the history, knows the culture, you are much more likely to find the soul of the place because you're getting something real. And you're not getting it through just the Chamber of Commerce. You're getting someone who says, this is where my friends and I go to hear music every night in Dublin. This is the hippest place to hear real Irish music. So that's a way to, in a sense, invite the mentor in. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
Because
yeah.
You're not just getting information. What I'm saying is do some due diligence and find someone funny, local, hip, someone who's proud to be Irish in Dublin, proud to be Greek. If you're in Delphi in Greece or if you're in Athens, find someone local. And what that person is doing, even though he or she may never not use the word, they're operating as a mentor for you. They're saying, Kevin, follow me. I'm going to show you the soul of Heraklion here on Crete. Don't go over there. That's just where the tourists go. Or don't go over there because there was this award-winning article in one of the fashionable travel magazines. And, oh, my God, now you can't even get a reservation over there.
Yeah.
So the mentor, broadly speaking, is the one who helps you find the soul of the place. And I know you're interested in place, but there are layers to a place. There's the superficial place. There is the tourist version, which is on all the tourist brochures. And then there is the soulful place. Yeah. And frankly, I think that's what most of us leave home for. And the reason I can say that is because the word tourist itself becomes a kind of bête noire, where...
Yeah.
You can sit in a cafe in Paris, for example, one of the great literary cafes, and if you sit there for a few hours, invariably you're going to hear someone say, oh my God, do you see that tourist over there? Tourist often becomes the most vilified term.
Yeah, right.
How is this possible? Right? Because we're all tourists on some level. But what people are saying is it's someone who travels superficially.
Yeah.
And my suggestion, without being self-righteous about it, is with some deep attention and a real reverence for the world, a reverence for history and for culture, we can get under the surface to find the underglimmer.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
Getting at this difference between
I think the view that the tourist gaze, as people are in academia will call it, versus this much more, sacred mode of travel. And I think it's really getting at the modes here. We change the mode. We change our lens. We walk a little bit differently. And
that's beautifully put. And here's a way to stretch the language a little bit, just in case people are still a little nervous about what might be misinterpreted as self-righteousness or a theological view. Another way to think about the pilgrim way of traveling is poetry. Yeah. A filmmaker, a travel writer, even an Anthony Bourdain out there looking for the best food, he's saying the food is the soul of the culture. That's how someone like him might talk about it. A poet might say, I want to write about the poetry of Vienna. These are all different ways to talk about what's true, what's deep, what's at the core, what's at the center of a place. And if we find it, we light up like Christmas trees, don't we? Oh, yeah. It's so thrilling. It's thrilling to find out what's true about a place as opposed to what's superficial about a place. So sometimes I'll just substitute the word poetic. Let's find out what's poetic about Dublin right now.
Yeah.
So let's go find out where Van Morrison hangs out, or where W.B. Yeats and his wife used to walk, and where Patrick Kavanaugh wrote his poetry. Because what a poet is looking for, what a filmmaker is looking for, what an anthropologist, by the way, might be looking for, is very, very akin to what a pilgrim is looking for. The truth.
Yeah. And is it personal poetic development?
With one little caveat, I think it's the overlap.
Yeah.
It's the overlap between what is there in itself, in the place, and the overlap of what we bring to the place.
Yeah.
So it's not just all of us. And that's one of my problems, frankly, with a lot of modern travel writing, where the place itself is often invisible in the travel story or the magazine account. It's all about how much time I prepared to leave home to find it, and all the struggles that I went through to get here to the heart of Croatia. It's all about the traveler. It's like the equivalent of the selfie stick for photographs. Rather than photographing the Taj Mahal or Machu Picchu, we're getting more and more and more and more photographs of someone standing in front of the place rather than experiencing it in that sacred moment. And some travel writing can be like that too.
Yeah.
So I like to think of an overlap.
Yeah.
Like the Venn diagram. So it's what we are bringing with our intensity, with our respect, with our belief that there is a soul of place.
Mm-hmm.
And then what is actually there, because we know about this because of modern physics, our very presence affects place, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And this is what anthropologists, as you just pointed out beautifully, are calling the tourist gaze. The tourist gaze can affect a place, and it can, as the English say, it can tart it up. So you spit polish a place just to pull in the tourist dollars, and that can make it very difficult for a traveler to find out, well, what is real about Glastonbury? Did King Arthur actually come here? Is this the origin of Camelot? It can take a great deal of homework, of research. And then there's the tourists affecting the place because of the way they look at it, the way they act when they're there. I like to think of do you know the German poet Novalis talks about how the soul is there where the inner and the outer world meet.
Yeah.
For me, that's a way to talk about the mystery of this kind of sacred travel, where we're bringing our deep, our honest self, and we're trying to find out what is deep and honest about the places we're visiting in the world.
So we have arrived at the end of episode 49, kicking off our fifth season of Geographical Imagination's radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Our hat off to Phil Cousineau for joining us from his home in San Francisco and for walking us through how to make travel sacred. Thanks to Phil. And thanks, as always, to Mike Allen for use of his song, Sand Dune, that you hear in the background. We are excited in this next month. We'll be putting together our 50th episode. It's hard to believe that Geographical Imaginations, at least when we measure by month, will turn 50 next month. Stay tuned for a special episode. Talk to you soon. See ya. Bye. Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing, is the key project of the Geographical Imaginations Expedition and Institute.